Good morning. President Trump's nominee to the Federal Reserve Board faces a Senate committee today. We question Democrat Elizabeth Warren, who will be questioning him about his views on Fed independence. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A federal judge says the Trump administration illegally froze billions of dollars in research money to Harvard. I'm Michelle Martin.
And Amy Martinez. She ruled that cutting money to study disease had nothing to do with fighting anti-Semitism, as the administration claimed. And Trump wants to send the National Guard into other cities. Can he do that? It's Thursday, September 4th. 30 years ago today, Xena, Warrior Princess, debuted on TV. I'll talk with star Lucy Lawless about the show's legacy and how it found an audience among LGBT viewers. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. A bipartisan effort is happening in the House. Some lawmakers want more records released about the investigation into late sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. NPR's Claudia Grisales reports more than two dozen women connected to the case spoke at the U.S. Capitol yesterday.
More than a dozen survivors told hundreds of rally goers the U.S. House needs to approve a bill led by Kentucky Republican Thomas Massey and California Democrat Ro Khanna to release the Epstein files. Marina Lacerda identified in Epstein's 2019 indictment as minor victim one, spoke publicly for the first time.
We are here. We want this bill to pass. It is very important, okay? And we need transparency. We are tired of looking at the news and seeing Jeffrey Epstein's name and saying that this is a hoax. We are tired of it.
House Republicans voted to support an oversight committee probe into the Epstein case. But survivors and lawmakers who want a comprehensive records release say that falls short. Claudia Grisales, NPR News, the Capitol.
Two children remain hospitalized from last week's mass shooting at the Annunciation Catholic Church and school in Minneapolis. Two children were killed. 21 others were hurt. Vice President Vance and Second Lady Usha Vance visited the church yesterday to meet with families of survivors. One of them was Harry Kaiser, whose daughter Lydia was shot and is now recovering at home. Kaiser urged Vance to take strong action on gun violence.
Will you please promise to pursue, despite powerful lobbies, some common sense bipartisan legislation as a starting point so we can come out of our corners and find the values that we share so that this time some progress is made?
Investigators say they've not yet found a clear motive for the shooter's attack. Florida is taking steps to become the first state to eliminate all vaccine mandates. From member station WUSF, Carrie Sheridan reports, polio and measles shots for children could be the first to go.
Florida's Surgeon General Joseph Latipo announced the move at a press conference near Tampa.
The Florida Department of Health, in partnership with the governor, is going to be working to end all vaccine mandates in Florida law. All of them.
He says the State Department of Health can start now by ending daycare and preschool requirements for about seven vaccines. Those include shots to prevent whooping cough, measles, mumps, rubella, polio, hepatitis B, and chickenpox. Major medical organizations continue to say these shots are safe and effective. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Sheridan in Tampa.
The World Health Organization says over the past half century, vaccines have saved more than 150 million lives. The WHO says of that number, more than 100 million were babies. The WHO says vaccines are the single greatest contribution of any health intervention to ensure babies are healthy. This is NPR. A House panel held a hearing yesterday on the use of artificial intelligence in mental health care. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee has details.
Among those testifying at the hearing was psychologist Vale Wright. She's senior director of healthcare innovation at the American Psychological Association. Wright said AI has the potential to benefit the mental health of patients and providers, for example, by alleviating burnout among providers by taking over administrative tasks or by delivering evidence-based treatments to patients. But she noted that unregulated chatbots are already causing harm.
One entertainment chatbot presenting itself as a psychologist engaged in millions of chats. And in another documented case, the chatbot appeared to validate a user's violent thoughts toward his family members. This is unacceptable.
She said youth are particularly vulnerable and that Congress should put in guardrails to protect them. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
President Trump is floating the idea of sending National Guard troops to New Orleans. He says Louisiana's governor, a Republican, would welcome them. National Guard troops have been sent to Los Angeles and they're still deployed in Washington, D.C., jurisdictions controlled by Democrats. Trump's comments come as he appeals a federal court judge's decision that his deployment of troops in L.A. last June was illegal. Nobody won the mammoth Powerball last night. The jackpot has now soared to $1.7 billion. If somebody gets the winning numbers, they would be eligible for the third largest jackpot in U.S. history. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Avalara, providing businesses with cloud-based tools and managed services for property tax compliance, from filing returns to tracking assessments. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Right on the corner of 1st and 1st Street, Minneapolis architect Edward Stibbins broke ground on a three-story warehouse. Open in 1889, it was known as the Produce Exchange. But the building had its heart set on higher things. It was soon acquired by a larger company that hired architect Cass Gilbert, who added a fourth floor. About a decade later, fires broke out on the inside, completely gutting the central spaces. Fortunately, the building was well insured and could be rebuilt. But this time, Gilbert, still the main architect, made the remodel fireproof. He bridged the north and south wing into one building, added steel bars on the windows and Italian Gothic detailing. The building was soon reopened as a storage facility, unique at the time for safety. Through the years, the Red Line brick building has been completely revolutionized for gathering people, a performance theater, an event center and renowned wedding venue, and now a church.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. President Trump is trying to exert more control over the Federal Reserve.
One test of that effort will come this morning when a Senate committee holds a hearing on Trump's nominee to fill a vacant seat on the Fed's governing board. In a few minutes, we'll hear from Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, a member of that committee. Trump is also hoping to fill a second seat by ousting Fed Governor Lisa Cook. That move is being challenged in court. The potential shakeup at the Fed poses a serious threat to the central bank's independence.
NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley is with us now to tell us more about this. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Scott, what are the stakes here? Is this mainly about Trump wanting lower interest rates?
Interest rates are certainly part of the story, but more broadly, this is about power and who gets to control decision-making at the Federal Reserve. Trump has made no secret of the fact he wants lower borrowing costs, and he's likely to get that wish when policymakers meet in a couple of weeks. That's because the job market is showing signs of softening, and lower interest rates might help to cushion that a little bit. But Trump wants more. He wants to install more of his own people at the central bank. He's nominated a White House economic advisor, Stephen Miron, to fill one vacancy on the Fed's board. And if he's successful in pushing Fed Governor Lisa Cook aside, he'll get a chance to put another ally on the board. That would mean 4 out of 7 Fed governors would be Trump appointees. And the president told reporters last week he's looking forward to that.
We'll have a majority very shortly, so that'll be great. Once we have a majority, housing is going to swing and it's going to be great. People are paying too high an interest rate.
Now, two caveats. One, the Fed does not directly control mortgage rates. Those are set in the bond market. So this move could actually backfire if investors come to think a Trump-dominated Fed might let inflation get out of control. And two, Congress set up the Fed to be insulated from exactly this kind of political pressure from the White House.
So, Scott, what's your sense of how this is going to play out?
Right now, the fight's being waged on two fronts. One's in the courts, where Lisa Cook has filed a lawsuit to prevent the president from firing her from the Fed board. Trump and his allies have accused Cook of mortgage fraud, but Cook denies that and says that's just a pretext to muscle her off the board. Well, that's being sorted out in the courts. The Senate has a chance to weigh in. We will hear in particular if any Senate Republicans stand up for Fed independence. They have done so in the past. We will see if they're willing to challenge the president this time.
Is Fed independence likely to come up at today's confirmation hearing?
Yeah, I'm sure we'll hear a lot of questions, at least from Democrats on the committee. Trump's nominee, Stephen Miron, co-authored a paper last year in which he argued the president should have more control over the Fed's Board of Governors. Now, he also suggested a ban on people moving from the White House to the Fed, although obviously that is not in effect right now. Most other advanced economies have decided it's a good idea to insulate their central banks from meddling by politicians. Fed Chairman Jerome Powell says it just makes for better long-term decision-making.
If you were not to have that, there would be a great temptation, of course, to use interest rates to affect elections, for example. And that's something that we don't want to do.
Powell's own term as Fed chairman runs out next May, and at that time, Trump will have the opportunity to name a new chairman. Powell could remain on the board as a Fed governor, however, through 2028. So far, the Fed chairman has not said whether he plans to stick around that long.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Scott, thank you.
You're welcome.
One of the senators questioning Stephen Miron is Massachusetts Democrat Elizabeth Warren. Warren and other Senate Democrats have voiced concerns over his nomination, in part due to his views on Fed independence. Our co-host Steve Inske spoke with Warren yesterday.
He is clearly a cheerleader for Donald Trump's economic policy. He agrees with the president, or the president agrees with him. I'm not sure who starts the ideas and who completes the ideas, but they play the game of hand in glove. And that is a real problem because the Federal Reserve is supposed to be independent of the president. And the big question is, will he?
Miron gives the impression that he does not necessarily believe in the full independence of the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, that's kind of a warning sign right there, isn't it? Look, today there will be a hearing about his nomination, but that is not the right hearing for the Banking Committee to have. Over the last few months, Donald Trump has launched three huge attacks on the independence of the Fed. First, threatening to fire Jerome Powell, then deciding that Powell had spent too much money on renovations of the Federal Reserve building and he could fire him for cause. And when that failed, now trying to fire Lisa Cook, another member of the Fed board. All of them direct attacks on the independence of the Fed. Right now, the Banking Committee should be investigating the president's direct attacks on that independence, not pretending that it's business as usual.
Given that the president has challenged the independence of the Fed and many other federal agencies in a way that nobody has seen for a long time, why does the independence of the Fed matter that much? To the average person, they may not get it.
If we have a totally politicized Fed, not a Fed that's making decisions about interest rates, for example, based on the best data they've got, but a Fed that says, "What do you want us to do, Mr. President?" then what happens is everyone loses confidence in the Fed, in our central bank, and in the decisions they make. And that ultimately drives up the cost of mortgages and car loans and credit cards for Americans across this country. And this isn't a theoretical argument here. We've actually seen this happen before. Countries where authoritarians take control of the central bank suffer from higher inflation. And who does it hit hardest? It hits working people across that country.
Some people will know that you have been sharply critical of Jerome Powell, the Fed chairman, from time to time. How would you rate his performance now?
Look, I've completely disagreed with Chair Powell since he was first nominated by Donald Trump. That's how far back he goes. I have disagreed with him on regulatory policy. I think he's way too easy on the banks. And I have disagreed with him on interest rate policy. I thought he should have lowered interest rates 2 years ago. And I have said so quite vocally and done my best to persuade him. But I have never, ever questioned the independence of the Fed and the Fed's ultimate power to make those decisions based on their best judgment of what's good for the United States of America.
So you, like the president, are hoping for an interest rate cut this month, it sounds like, but you're saying your methods are different.
Yes, but what I don't want to see is that Donald Trump has squeezed out the independence of the Fed, and that he's managed to get his own lackeys in there, that he's managed to fire someone at the Fed, because as soon as that happens, the value that the United States has built up literally for more than a century by having an independent Fed, we lose the gold standard, and ultimately that costs the American economy, and it also, most importantly, costs American workers.
Do you believe that your colleagues privately, your Republican colleagues, are concerned?
Oh, yeah, I think some of them are. We need independence, really across the board, for our financial regulators. Because as soon as the politicians can grab them by the throat and say, for political reasons, here's the economic decision I want you to make, people start to understand that the whole game is being played on a political playing field, not an economic playing field. That doesn't make for a stronger economy. That doesn't build our GDP. And it sure doesn't make life better for American workers.
Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you.
Oh, always good to talk with you, too. Thanks for having me.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio says there could be more U.S. strikes on suspected drug traffickers. He made the warning in Mexico before he traveled on to Ecuador. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports that fighting the drug trade and illegal migration are key topics during the trip.
The U.S. military strike on a boat from Venezuela was meant to be a message to cartels in the region. That's how Secretary Rubio described it as he stood alongside his Mexican counterpart at a news conference in the capital.
If you're on a boat full of cocaine or fentanyl or whatever headed to the United States, you're an immediate threat to the United States. And the president, under his authority as commander-in-chief, has a right under exigent circumstances to eliminate imminent threats to the United States.
He says that's what Trump did on Tuesday, ordering a strike on a boat from Venezuela. Rubio says the U.S. will continue to hit groups that it considers narco-terrorists.
We're not going to sit back anymore and watch these people sail up and down the Caribbean like a cruise ship. It's not going to happen anymore. They're not going to bring drugs into the United States. We're going to stop them.
When it comes to Mexico, Rubio says the two countries have reached a level of historic cooperation on combating the drug trade and illegal migration. Mexican Foreign Minister Juan Ramón de la Fuente echoed that, though he stressed that their cooperation is based on mutual respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. He used those terms many times during their joint press conference, especially when asked about the pressure the Trump administration is putting on Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro.
We believe on self-determination, non-intervention, peaceful solution of controversies. All countries are legally equal. We believe in cooperation for development, and so on.
De La Fuente was upbeat about Rubio's visit, though, and the meeting with Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, calling it productive. The secretary is now in Ecuador, where the drug trade and immigration will top the agenda again. His aides say he's also looking for ways to help this country get out from under what they call a giant albatross, Ecuador's $2.5 billion debt to China. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Quito, Ecuador.
This is NPR News.
Now's your chance to see one of the most acclaimed indie rock artists of the past 20 years at Grand Rapids Urfest, going on Saturday, September 6th. In addition to Courtney Barnett, you'll get to see Alan Sparhawk, Jeremy Albino, and Margo Price.
Don't let the bastards get you down. Don't sell your heart to no businessman.
You can get your tickets for Grand Rapids Riverfest at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com. You won't want to miss one of the biggest concert nights in northern Minnesota this year.
NPR comes from this station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for dedicated and forward-thinking individuals to join their growing team. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From UKG, delivering HR, pay, time, and culture products and services, dedicated to helping clients build a great workplace for their people. UKG.com/great. UKG, our purpose is people. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. 30 years ago today, a new woman-led fantasy show began a conquest of syndicated television. That is the battle cry of Xena, Warrior Princess. The series was a spinoff of Hercules, The Legendary Journeys. And it didn't take long for Xena to surpass Hercules' TV ratings. The star of Xena, Lucy Lawless, was not surprised one bit.
To be honest, I was so green that I thought for sure it would be a hit. And I just thought that's naturally what happens.
And that is what happened. Lucy Lawless and her husband, Robert Tappert, an executive producer of the show, joined me from New Zealand to reminisce about how Xena found its audience. Did you have a period of finding your footing as a show?
I think we were shooting episode 8 when we started getting reports from like the Village Voice, and they were hailing the characters as gay icons. And Renee and I were amused as hell reading this on the side of the set going, did you ever? Well, you know, like, that's amazing. We knew that we had hit a groove because the gay community and our fandom was also particularly internet savvy right at the beginning in 1995. And it just caught on with the burgeoning of that technology, a hunger for female-led shows, just everything aligned.
Yeah, and that relationship between Xena and Gabrielle played by Renee O'Connor, in a lot of spaces it was controversial. In other spaces, as you mentioned, Lucy, it was a point of pride. It sounded like you at first thought, where are these ideas coming from? But, I mean, they were there, and were they intentional?
No, not really. Certainly not at the start of the show, because the studio was so adamant that the show not be perceived as that, that they wouldn't let Lucy or Renee be in the same shot in the title sequence. But the audience eventually read into what they wanted, which was interesting because they never assumed Hercules and Aeolus were gay. And then once we heard it, we started to drip feed into that. But it was always meant to be a show that worked for 6 to 60, we would say. So it had to walk a fine line, which is some people get the joke and others don't.
Well, as you mentioned, Rob, so it's two women in a very close relationship. I mean, although, you know, things are hinted, at least the way the viewers perceive it. But who exactly were those themes for, do you think?
First and foremost was to tell an adventure show that made the audience feel something, and not necessarily one about the sexuality, but more about a character on the road to redemption.
And the effect that it had on the audience, the messages that they took on it, we could not have foreseen. And I don't just mean like with the, were they or were they not lesbian? Because you can't control people's minds, you know?
Yeah. I guess, yeah, that's the way it works. You put some art out in the world and you never know how people are going to react to it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Today, that storyline would not raise an eye, right? I mean, were there times where you were worried that maybe the network was a little too sensitive about the relationship and the implied relationship between the two as a couple? Was that something that you worried about when you were writing storylines?
The studio was pretty hands-off. We knew we wanted to be a transgressive show, and we wanted Xena to be pushing the borders at that time. But in 1995, and it's not all that long ago, but it was a different world, we had Xena have a series of ex-lovers in the first 7 episodes who were all men of color. So we were pushing the borders racially at the start, and eventually sexuality came into it.
Yeah. Let me ask you, like, the last episode, the water transfer scene.
Gabriel.
So Xena is in a battle. She gets injured to the point where she needs water from a magical fountain to regain her strength. She can't get to it, but Gabrielle can, and she has no other way to carry the water other than to carry it in her mouth and give it to Xena. That became this big moment in Xena history, I think, because it became like the first, at least real, kiss in a lot of people's eyes. Getting to that part, to filming that scene, did you both realize what kind of an impact that scene would have on fans and then maybe people that didn't really like the show because of the themes alike?
No, to us it was just like, oh, that's the story. That's what we're doing today. We never thought about the impact on anybody. Rob, what do you think?
Well, actually, because I was there and directing the final episode, Lucy and Renee kind of went, all right, we finally got here. So they knew exactly what that moment was about.
Oh,
so
okay, I've forgotten.
Yes, it was very much, we are going to finally pay this off and give the fans what they asked for.
Do you two ever go to any of the conventions that are held? I know there's one in Burbank, California, a XenaCon. I mean, do you two ever show up to any of those things?
That's the only one that I go to, and they do a lot for charity. So we do it for charity, that event.
What do you hear from people when you go? What do they tell you about how they feel about the character and you and the show?
The prevailing notion is that this show freed me to be more of myself. Whether it's, there's a lot of people that struggled against the situation they grew up in, maybe sickness, illness, and it gave them courage. They took that notion of, I'm an imperfect person who deserves to be fabulous, and they made it real in their lives, and they seem to thank me and the show for that, though I was only saying somebody else's words, really.
No, but you don't give yourself enough credit, Lucy. I mean, you're the title character. You're the image that people are going to always remember, and it's your artistic portrayal that made this such a memorable show. So, I mean, I hate to tell you that, but come on, feel good about what you did.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I one time had that realization. Uh-huh. I've forgotten it now, but because my life, I don't live in the past, yeah. You know, I don't think about something when it's done, it's letters, but I just got so much out of it. I'm honored to have been part of something that did so much good for people in their lives.
That is Lucy Lawless and Rob Tapper. Thank you two for reminiscing with me about Xena, Warrior Princess.
Oh, thanks for having us.
It's been a delight. Thank you very much. And to all you fans of the show, we're certainly glad that you tuned in.
This is NPR News.
Should ancient vehicles be sold, donated, recycled?
Would you like to buy my minivan?
I would not like to buy your minivan.
And what happens to all the metal and hazardous fluids? Our reporter parts with the family Vanny, who's 20 years old with 183,000 miles and...
Wasps! Oh, and Vanny!
It has wasps. The fate of Vanny on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock here on KAXE. Your local host is Andrew Dzingel. It's 529. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, it's our Daily Dose of Nature with John Latimer. We are expecting patchy frost around the region early this morning. Showers are likely, mostly cloudy skies, highs near 55. Winds out of the northwest 5 to 10 could gust higher. Evening lows tonight around 40. Mostly cloudy for tomorrow, Friday. Highs 55 to 58 with breezy northwest winds. We're getting ready for this week's Grand Rapids River Fest. It is coming up on Saturday. Have you been? We want you to tell us about your Riverfest experiences or other live concerts you went to because you heard them on KAXE. Text us your stories, 218-326-1234. If you haven't heard yet, tickets are still available to Grand Rapids Riverfest on Saturday. This year's lineup, Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Tickets and information at GrandRapidsRiverfest.com. If you want to volunteer at the event, you can head to GrandRapidsRiverfest.com under Get Involved. Thanks to people like you, listeners, we have raised over $162,000 during this crisis caused by federal cuts to public funding. KAXE is working hard to keep the programming you love going strong. Every action helps. Donate, share our work, tell someone about us, buy a ticket to the Grand Rapids River Fest. Visit KAXE.org right now to find out more. It is the Sunrise edition of Stay Human this weekend. Stories from the early risers. That means John Latimer reporting on the pre-dawn action. Rich McClear checks in from the land of the rising sun. And Michael Goldberg stays up all night for the rosy pink fingers of dawn. It's our weekly mix of words and music. Saturday mornings at 9, Sunday at 5. Right now it's time for John Latimer.
On today's date, I had a lovely hike in the woods in Balsam Township with a fellow named Al Hupula. And Al was a great woodsman and a wonderful associate. We had many nice walks in the woods. On this day, we came across northern holly, just becoming ripe. They have bright orange berries in the fall, almost tending to scarlet. And those berries are very, very bitter, very foul-tasting berries. They're filled with a chemical called saponin, and that saponin is in there to keep the birds from eating the berries before they're fully ripe. And it delays the consumption of the berries by the birds until late September, early October, when the plant will recover the saponins from the berries, store it in its plant tissues, and use it again next year. But the berries then become palatable to the birds, and white-throated sparrows and robins will hover on these bushes and consume all of those berries before very long into the future. Every bit as good as a finger covered in earwax. Very, very bitter.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California.
And I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C. Good morning. A federal judge in Boston handed Harvard University a big win on Wednesday.
The judge says the Trump administration unlawfully froze more than $2 billion in research funding to the school. The administration put the freeze in place in what it says was a response to allegations of anti-Semitism on campus, which prompted Harvard to sue.
NPR education correspondent Corey Turner has been looking over the judge's 84-page ruling, and is with us now to tell us more about it. Corey, good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So what can you tell us about how the funding freeze, according to the judge, ran afoul of the law?
Yeah, Judge Allison Burroughs offered really not one argument, but several. For starters, she pointed out that the research being defunded at Harvard included studies of Alzheimer's, cancer, Lou Gehrig's disease, heart disease, autism. There was even a study to help emergency room doctors better serve suicidal veterans, none of which, the judge said, had any clear connection to anti-Semitism on campus. Burroughs also said the freeze violated Harvard's First Amendment rights, and that's because at the same time the Trump administration claimed it was doing this to fight anti-Semitism, President Trump was excoriating Harvard more broadly on Truth Social for being a, quote, liberal mess, and for fighting back against the administration. So the judge said she found it, quote, difficult to conclude anything other than that the administration used anti-Semitism as a smokescreen for a targeted, ideologically motivated assault.
You know, Corey, it's interesting. Harvard has said that anti-Semitism had become a problem on campus. Does the judge speak to that?
Yeah, in a ruling, Judge Burroughs was kind of hard on Harvard, saying, quote, it had been plagued by anti-Semitism in recent years and could and should have done a better job of dealing with the issue. But she said Harvard was already taking steps to do just that when the Trump administration froze its funding. In fact, this was actually another way the administration, she said, had run afoul of federal law. It had accused Harvard of violating Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the landmark law that protects Americans from discrimination based on race, color, and national origin. But Title VI requires a very clear step-by-step process for the government to follow to bring a school into compliance. And the judge said jumping straight to this huge funding freeze essentially skipped most of those steps.
So what happens now?
Well, White House spokesperson Liz Houston said, quote, we will immediately move to appeal this egregious decision, and we're confident we will ultimately prevail. Meanwhile, Harvard President Alan Garber's statement was notably subdued, pledging to, quote, continue to assess the implications of the opinion, monitor further legal developments, and be mindful of the changing landscape. And I think, Michelle, that's a nod to the fact that Harvard and the White House have been battling on multiple fronts here, while also talking behind the scenes about a potential settlement agreement, like the ones already signed by Columbia and Brown University. It's hard to know what effect this ruling is ultimately going to have, but I think it's pretty clear it strengthens Harvard's bargaining position.
That is NPR education correspondent Corey Turner. Corey, thank you.
You're welcome, Michelle.
President Trump continues to talk about deploying National Guard troops to various cities. On Tuesday, he sent a message to Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker.
I would love to have Governor Pritzker call me. I'd gain respect for him and say, we do have a problem, and we'd love you to send in the troops, because you know what? The people, they have to be protected.
So here's what Pritzker said about that.
Let me be clear. The president is begging me to call him to ask him to do something that we don't want.
So what happens now? Can Trump deploy troops to other cities like he says he will, or at least wants to? And what if governors like Pritzker keep saying no? Let's ask Stephen Vladek about this. He's a professor of law at Georgetown University who has been writing about the legal authority for Guard deployments in his One First Substack. Professor Vladek, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Michelle. Great to be with you.
So as we just heard there, President Trump seems to be asking or trying to pressure Governor Pritzker into asking Trump to send him the Guard. Why would he do that? Is that an acknowledgement that he doesn't have, that the president does not have the authority to send troops where they are not welcome?
I think at the very least, Michelle, it is a concession that it's a lot easier legally for the president to send in troops with a request from the governor. Michelle, let's not forget, Governor Pritzker has his own National Guard, the Illinois National Guard, that he would be free to deploy if he thought the circumstances warranted. President Trump could could invoke some old and not often used authorities, a statute known as the Insurrection Act, for example, to send in troops without the governor's consent. Mm-hmm. But I think what he's really trying to get at is, can he actually have his cake and eat it too? Can he send in troops without using that controversial statute and without the governor's consent? That's really the mess that we're seeing this week.
So then the president mentioned the possibility of sending guard forces to New Orleans, which Louisiana's Republican governor seemed to welcome. And that seems to recall something that you wrote about back in 2020 when the president relied upon friendly governors to send troops to Washington, D.C. in the wake of the George Floyd protest. Now, you know, obviously they didn't stay for long. It was a different situation. D.C. is a legal unicorn, as we know. But what do you make of this shift to more receptive governors?
I think it really gives up the game, Michelle, on how empty all of this is. You know, Governor Landry, like Governor Pritzker, is the commander-in-chief of his own state National Guard, the Louisiana National Guard. If there were enough, you know, lawlessness and disorder in New Orleans to justify more than just an ordinary law enforcement response, Governor Landry doesn't need President Trump. He can do it himself. And so I think what we're really seeing, Michelle, is a lot of theater on the part of the Trump administration, where it's trying to look like it is the savior for situations that have far more local, far more legally settled remedies if they actually warrant them.
So let's go back to the Substack. You wrote a lengthy one, and it's very sort of interesting and very detailed about what might the legal path be for the president to actually send the National Guard into places that people don't want them, or the governors, the officials there don't want them.
Right. So there are two avenues, Michelle. So the first is one we talked about briefly a couple minutes ago, which is federalizing the National Guard. It's what President Trump tried to do in California. You know, he just got slapped down on Tuesday by a federal judge in Cisco. What Trump is contemplating, Michelle, is something more obscure. You mentioned the 2020 use of out-of-state National Guard troops in D.C. Michelle, that was in the context in which they weren't federalized, in which 11 states just let the president borrow their National Guard troops. And I think the critical point here is that's where we'd be in uncharted territory if the governor were to try to use that authority to send, for example, the Texas National Guard into a state that didn't want them.
Before we let you go, just briefly, do you think this matter is going to end up before the Supreme Court?
I think the next move is up to President Trump. If he carries through on his threat to send unfederalized National Guard troops from one state into another without that state's consent, there will definitely be litigation. It will almost certainly end up in the Supreme Court. And that's a good thing, because the alternative is a face-to-face confrontation.
That's Stephen Vladeck, a law professor at Georgetown University, and this is NPR News.
It's 5:42. More is ahead from Morning Edition here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. We'd love to hear from you this morning. Coming up at 6:20, I'm going to be chatting with Jeff Sundin, our early bird fishing guide. Are you excited for fall fishing? You have any questions about where the fish are moving to? You can text me at 218-326-1234. Local businesses, you can help defend the future of KAXE and keep people-powered radio on the air with your sponsorship dollars. Visit kexe.org/give to learn about sponsoring options. Big thank you to all of our current business sponsors. That includes Blandin Foundation, strengthening rural Minnesota. More at blandinfoundation.org. We would also like to thank The Sewing Room, hosting the Cultivating Community Summit, a two-day gathering to explore belonging, workforce inclusion, environmental justice, and more. Taking place at the Gitche Zibi Center for the Arts in Brainerd, September 22nd and 23rd. Registration is available at sewingroom.org. Weather, it is a chilly morning on this September 4th. We do have a frost advisory in effect, or that is possibly out there. If you're up right now, let me know what temperature it is where you are. Be a weather watcher for us. Text 218-326-1234. Highs in the mid-50s today. Thanks for tuning in. Coming up September 6th, we are so excited for Grand Rapids River Fest. Opening up will be Alan Sparhawk, who recently talked with Kari Hedlund about his new album with Trampled by Turtles.
I remember the time going like, man, I can't tell if this is any good. I'm questioning myself a lot here, but I don't know. There was a little bit of obligation, I think, because those guys had made room for me, put their trust in me, so to speak. I kind of had to tell myself, you know, I just need to push through and just sing, do the best I can, and trust that I'm in the hands of good people. I feel like I did. I found my voice. Thank you for thinking of me, and I'm glad to be there. Mim and I grew up out past Bemidji, so I'm looking forward to it.
Grand Rapids River Fest with Alan Sparhawk opening up, then Jeremy Albino, Margo Price, and Courtney Barnett. Get your tickets at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
Comes from this station. And from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm A. Martinez. The NFL season kicks off tonight in Philadelphia. The defending champion Eagles host the Dallas Cowboys. And week one is going global as Kansas City meets the LA Chargers Friday in Sao Paulo, Brazil, the league's second kickoff in that city. Now, to sort all the early storylines, we're joined by Neil Greenberg, sports columnist and data analyst at the Washington Post. So, Neil, let's start off with that first game of the season, the Super Bowl champs going up against the Cowboys, their division rival. What are you watching for tonight?
I'm watching for Philadelphia Eagles quarterback Jalen Hurts. He's a little bit of a polarizing figure. The analytics love him. The more subjective ways of grading him are a little more harsh. Matter of fact, they just had a big poll with executives, scouts, etc., and he was almost put into the second tier of quarterbacks.
What? He's a champion. What more does he have to do?
Yeah, he's a polarizing figure. But it's a great game. I'm curious to see how Dallas does after they traded their best player, Micah Parsons, after a tumultuous offseason. So it's going to be a really good game, I think, but maybe a little bit lopsided.
All right, now beyond tonight, what are you watching for this season? Are the Chiefs, the Kansas City Chiefs, are they built for another run?
There's some cracks showing. I mean, they're getting older. I mean, Travis Kelce is nearing the end of his career. He's beginning his new life, but his football life might be coming to an end. So it's going to be tough for them, I think, to keep going at the high level they were. They're certainly a contender, but I think they're starting to make way for other Super Bowl hopefuls like Baltimore, Buffalo, Philadelphia.
Or I knew you were about to say the Chargers, too, in those Super Bowl contender lists. So speaking of Travis Kelce, the Super Bowl is set for February in Santa Clara, California. Travis Kelce will not be playing in that game because my Chargers will be the AFC team in that game. But what are the chances? What are the chances that Travis Kelce will be watching his fiance Taylor Swift perform the halftime show?
Yeah, that's starting to get a little bit of buzz. Roger Goodell mentioned that it's a maybe. It certainly makes a lot of sense. I mean, it's pretty easy to connect the dots as to why Taylor Swift would be at the top of the list. Not only because she's a mega superstar, but obviously her football connection. I think it'd be an amazing show. Probably see Travis Kelce on stage. If your Chargers did happen to make it to the Super Bowl, maybe he would do a little skit up there. But I think there's probably a better chance that he's not able to watch her than the Chargers, but we can save that for a different show.
I mean, think about it. I mean, it's the halftime show. The album that's coming out is Life of a Show Girl. I mean, to me, you're a data analyst. I mean, it makes the sense. The data makes sense that she's performing in the halftime show.
Oh, I think you just connected all the dots. I think that this is going to happen. I think we just broke some news.
Yeah, except that you're not with me on the Chargers thing, which is very disappointing, Neil. Very disappointing.
I can get on board. Keep talking. I'll get on board.
All right, one more thing really quick. Travis Hunter, Jacksonville Jaguars, a defensive back and wide receiver. He's going to play both positions this year. I don't think that's ever been done, really, a long time ago.
Well, yeah, Deion Sanders did it. He played both sides. It's exciting. He's an electric player. He's another player that's certainly going to be a storyline this season. How many reps he gets on offense, how many reps he gets on defense, and then how well does he do? Yeah. I think this is great for the sport, especially after what we've seen in baseball.
Cool. All right, Neil Greenberg, sports columnist at the Washington Post. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Join us for the 5th Annual Grand Rapids River Fest, Saturday, September 6th, presented by KAXE, the City of Grand Rapids, and sponsored by Grand Rapids State Bank. The lineup features Courtney Barnett, Margot Price, Jeremy Albino, and Alan Sparhawk. Come along for a day of great music along the banks of the Mississippi River. Tickets available now at GrandRapidsRiverFest.com.
President Trump might reshape the Federal Reserve.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is currently looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who are interested in building a career and joining an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. President Trump has been relentless in attacking the country's central bank, and he now has his first chance at shaping it. He's nominated Stephen Miron, one of his advisors, to serve on the Fed's Board of Governors, where he could vote on such things as interest rate policy. The Senate Banking Committee is holding a hearing on this later this morning. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the details. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning.
So tell us about Miron. Who is he? Where did he come from?
Well, he is currently chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors at the White House. He was also a senior strategist at the investment firm Hudson Bay Capital, and he was a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute.
What does Mr. Miron say about his qualifications for the job of Fed governor?
Well, his opening statement for today's hearing has been released, and in it he says part of his current job is to advise President Trump on achieving full employment and stable prices, which is the Fed's mandate. He says the Council of Economic Advisors and the Fed share common goals. He also says his time in the markets gave him firsthand experience in the substantial sway the Fed holds over the ability to borrow money.
What does he have to say about Fed independence? I mean, considering all the pressure President Trump is putting on the central bank to lower interest rates?
Yeah, in his opening statement, Miron says he intends to preserve the Fed's independence. But in an essay for the Manhattan Institute last year, Miron wrote the president should be able to remove Fed officials, quote, at will. And that opinion is expected to get some attention today, especially considered that President Trump is now trying to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook.
All right. Thanks, Nancy.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration has asked the Supreme Court to uphold the legality of his tariffs. Two lower courts so far have found the president does not have the authority to impose many of them. If these tariffs were to be struck down, the government might have to refund billions to businesses that paid them. Arguments could be as early November. These would not affect tariffs on certain products like steel, aluminum, or pharmaceuticals. All right, let's do the numbers. Dow futures are barely up, less than 0.1%. S&P futures are up 0.2%. NASDAQ futures up 0.3%.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need. And by Avalara, providing cloud-based solutions for businesses to manage property tax compliance. Learn more at avalara.com/property tax.
There are black markets for a lot of things, from drugs to data, also for ants. Yeah, ants. And business is booming. Kate Nibbs is a senior writer at Wired, where she recently wrote about the connection between federal staffing cuts and the rise in the illicit ant trade. Hi, Kate.
Thanks so much for having me.
So federal staffing cuts and ant smuggling. Please explain.
Yeah, not the two things that you think of off the top of your head, but they go together in a big way because a lot of people who were cut from the USDA were really prestigious entomologists. And some of them worked on pest control. Some of them have been hired back, but there's just a sense within the ant black market that no one is really paying attention. And so the results might, unfortunately, be for all of us, a rise in invasive species unleashed upon the United States.
What does the illicit ant trade look like?
So I think there are two distinct wings of the illicit ant trade. There's a smaller group of people who are trading exotic ants that are really not supposed to be in the United States, that if they were let loose in certain states, they could really wreak havoc in the larger ecosystem. Then there's a much larger group of people who are trading ants sort of accidentally. People actually need permits to sell ants between states. So a large percentage of the amount of the ants that you see for sale on platforms like eBay or Amazon are being sold by people who probably haven't gotten the correct permits and are thus participating in the black market.
And of course, I mean, the risk of playing fast and loose with, you know, a potential invasive species is there's economic damage there, potentially.
Oh, yes. In states where invasive ant species have shown up, there have been situations where like the ants will chew through electrical wires and cause a lot of damage in like construction and just people's residences. And then, of course, there's like a huge public health implication if the ants are venomous or bite or otherwise harm people if they come in contact with them. It's like obviously a niche concern, but the potential threat is actually pretty serious.
Yeah. Now, based on your reporting, it seems like the black market ant trade like was not particularly strictly regulated before the Trump administration. So what's happening that would allow it to sort of explode as you're observing?
Yeah. So this is definitely a situation where we didn't really have it under control to begin with. And because people in the community are aware of the cuts, they're not really trying to get permits anymore. And they're also apparently going out and collecting queens and selling them more aggressively. And a lot of my sources told me that there's some people from outside of the United States who are actually now coming into the United States and collecting ants and then selling them internationally because they perceive it to just be sort of a wild, wild west.
I mean, ultimately, this is really about more than ants. Do you think that the U.S.'s ability to control poached animals, invasive animals, invasive plants, the pests they bring, all the biological threats to the U.S. Agriculture system and environment, has that been eroded, do you think?
Based on my conversations with people who were in positions where they were trying to do this work and now aren't, yes. And it's scary. It genuinely is scary, even though ants seem like such a niche thing. They are sort of a signal for this wider collapse in enforcement in protecting our environment from invasive species.
Kate Nibbs is a senior writer at Wired. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.
Coming up, news headlines from National Public Radio. An hour from now, we bring you the local news with the Up North Report. I'm Heidi Holton, and this is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. People-powered radio in northern Minnesota, you can join us at KAXE.com. farmersmarketsnow.org. The KAXC Newsroom has created a map of northern Minnesota farmers markets throughout our region, from places like Park Rapids to Palo, Talmoon to Reamer, and Black Duck to Crosby. Most markets run through September or October. You can find the map right now at KAXC.org. After Dark is KAXC's Saturday night program after Green Cheese from 9 to midnight, featuring styles of music like punk and metal, hip-hop, and more. If you want to host, you can email dgannon@kaxc.org. Frost Advisor.